Deutsche Welle. Africa Link.
Welcome to Africa Link. I'm Isaac Mugabe in Bonn, Germany. Coming up, the International Criminal Court has postponed indefinitely the trial of Kenyan President Uhuru Kenyatta. These are some of the reactions from the streets of Nairobi.
I'm pleased. I'm happy for it. I feel basically there was no case from the first instance.
We knew the whole thing was political.
Personally, I'm disappointed that the case has been adjourned indefinitely.
And Berlin commemorates 20 years after the end of apartheid in South Africa with a performance from renowned trumpeter Hugh Masekela. Also on the program, we'll hear the story of a young girl who refused to be forced into marriage by her parents in Niger. Stay tuned.
Top story.
The International Criminal Court's Chief Prosecutor Fatou Bensouda on Friday asked judges to indefinitely postpone the start of Kenyan President Uhuru Kenyatta's Crimes Against Humanity trial, saying Nairobi was refusing to cooperate. The trial of the Kenyan leader on five counts related to post-election violence dating back to 2007-2008 has been dogged by repeated delays. President Kenyatta is accused of stoking a wave of lethal inter-ethnic violence after Kenya's elections in 2007, when more than 1,000 people were killed. DW's Alfred Kitty in Nairobi went out to seek people's views on the court's announcement and sent this report.
I'm pleased. I'm happy for it. I feel basically there was no case from the first instance.
We thank Uhuru that he has stood his ground all through and just have given to the pressure. We knew the whole thing was political.
The whole scenario was faulty. There's no transparency from the beginning to me. No proper investigation was done.
Benson Nyangweso is one of those who were displaced during the post-election violence.
Personally, I'm disappointed that the case has been adjourned indefinitely. That means that the prosecutor didn't have enough evidence to prosecute, or maybe she's still gathering enough material to prosecute. But I'm disappointed in the sense that the case could not proceed.
Some see a strong tribal element in the case, with people from Uhuru Kenyatta's community terming his victory during the 2013 general election as a reaction to his indictment at the ICC. John Mwangi explains how the indictment influenced him.
In the first instance, previously I would not have voted for him. After that ICC thing came about, I gave him my vote, and that is how he won.
For Benson Nyangweso, this is tribalism.
This is not about politics. It's not about where we come from. Where it's about the rule of law. It's about justice. Someone has to be answerable to this.
The case against Kenyatta had been postponed several times as prosecutors tried to gather evidence against him. Several witnesses who had been lined up to testify against Uhuru have since disappeared or have withdrawn their testimony. A Nairobi-based legal expert, Kibatia Gashie, says the adjournment is an indication that the case did not hold any weight.
That is a relief to the president, but we'll wait and see after we have read the ruling of the judges as to whether the prosecution has been given time to look for more evidence. These people did not properly gather evidence before prosecuting, and now it is becoming clear with the admission by the prosecution that it has no evidence.
Uhuru Kenyatta's lawyers had several times asked the prosecution to drop the case for lack of evidence. However, ICC prosecutor Fatou Bensouda says the case could continue at a later date once the Kenyan government provides the information requested by the court. However, victims of the violence that followed the 2007 general election are now worried that justice will not be attained.
Alfred Kitty reporting from Nairobi. Before we came on air, I spoke to Mark Ellis from the International Bar Association in London, and he starts by telling us what this new development means for the trial of President Uhuru.
This has been an ongoing problem that is based primarily on two issues. One, the case seems not to be as strong as originally thought, and that's based primarily on the fact that witnesses that were very key to the original indictment have either been found to be dubious in their truthfulness, or they're simply fearful of testifying, and so they have on their own said they will no longer testify. So that's weakened the prosecutor's case. But the second issue is the Kenyan government has clearly not been that cooperative with the court, has not provided the type of information requested by the court. And so the prosecutor really has no other alternative than to continue to delay because she simply does not have sufficient evidence to move forward with the case.
Do you see any chance that the ICC could still put pressure on the Kenyan government to cooperate?
The ICC and certainly the prosecutor really does not have the type of mechanisms to force the Kenyan government to cooperate. This is really dependent on the international community to assist the International Criminal Court and the prosecutor in forcing the Kenyan government to cooperate with the court. And so far, the international community and the UN Security Council have failed to do that.
Now, what if the international community remains silent because of strategic interests and Kenya as well doesn't cooperate? Isn't that the end of the matter?
It will be the end of the matter. We're at a bit of a stalemate here. And so there are two ways to go. Either the international community and the Security Council can permit the Kenyan government to continue to obstruct these proceedings, or the international community and specifically U.S. Security Council can alter their position and put greater pressure on the Kenyan government to cooperate with the court. This is a fundamental decision that has to be made because it really goes to the heart of justice and really the validity of the court.
How much of a setback is this for the chief prosecutor, Fatou Bensouda, personally?
Because I think this is not something that happened overnight. This has been an ongoing issue. I think it should not be perceived as a defeat against her. It should be viewed more of an indictment against the international community and the Security Council for failing to put pressure on the Kenyan government to cooperate with the court.
As an international lawyer, do you see this case or this trial ever taking place, or this is the end of it?
I think as it stands right now, I think it's very difficult to see this case going forward unless there's a sea change within the international community, in particular the Security Council.
I was speaking to Mark Ellis from the International Bar Association in London.
Africa Link, bringing you the story behind the story.
UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon has announced plans to set up an Ebola crisis center to coordinate the response to the deadly virus and to strive to halt its spread in West African countries within 6 to 9 months. He equally reminded the international community to provide the $600 million needed for supplies in the affected countries. For its part, the European Union has committed 140 million euros to fight Ebola, a sharp increase over its previous pledge as the outbreak worsens. In the meantime, the World Health Organization, WHO, has given the green light to untested therapies and vaccines to be used in the treatment of Ebola virus. DW's Richard Walker spoke to the U.S. Center for Disease Control's top epidemiologist for Ebola, Dr. Barbara Knust, on the role these vaccines could play in stopping the virus.
Well, the experimental drugs that have been used in just a few patients, certainly there's a lot of interest on the part of many people around the world about whether they might be helpful. And there's also additional therapeutics that have been in discussion. But there really is a lot of work needed to really find out what the true therapeutic benefit would be. There really is a double-edged sword that we are confronted with some of these experimental treatments. Because on the one hand, we have a drug that really hasn't been tested in people. And if we put it into a population in Africa that is disadvantaged, people might say, well, you're experimenting on these people. But if you don't provide it to these people that are clearly affected by the disease and where it is such a crisis, then people also say, well, you're not helping them and you're not helping the situation. I think it is very important to make sure that these drugs are effective and safe before they're given to a population that already has some issues of resistance and not trusting the public health efforts.
Meanwhile, the outbreak in West Africa just keeps getting bigger, doesn't it? The World Health Organization is now talking about 20,000 possible cases in the future. Why is this outbreak so big?
The outbreak is really spreading rapidly, and it has a lot to do with the locations where people are getting infected. We have essentially outbreaks going on in slum conditions, particularly in Liberia and Sierra Leone, where people can have a lot of contact, and that there also is a lot of trouble with being able to identify the people that are most likely to become ill, which is how we've previously managed outbreaks. And at this point, it's at a point where we have to be thinking about things other than just tracing the contacts, but really thinking about just providing good care, but being able to keep the people who are sick from passing on the disease to other people as well.
That was Dr. Barbara Knust from the Center for Disease Control.
Human rights.
Let's now head to Niger, where children are forced into early marriage, hence denying them a right to a happy childhood. In Niger, 3 out of 4 girls under the age of 18 are married, and in some rural areas, activists say, girls are still considered as the parents' property to be given away in marriage as and when they please. But some girls are fighting back. DW's Naomi Conrad met a young woman in Zinda in southern Niger, who took desperate measures to fight for her right for a childhood and education.
In the deserted, slightly grimy restaurant, Zainabu Musa is sitting on a wobbly plastic chair, nervously pulling at her headscarf. She's a slight girl who averts her eyes every time she's asked a question. And yet, the 16-year-old commands respect, maybe even a trace of fear in our male translator. After all, she's Zainabu, or, as many call her now, Zainabu, the penis biter.
When he tried to force me, I beat him, and then he fainted.
Without looking up, Zainabu smiles. It's a small, shy smile that belies the fear and panic she felt on the day in her village in southern Niger when her parents married her off against her will. She was 15 and had begged them time and time again to let her finish her education. But her parents, she says, were adamant. They decided it was time for Zainabu to become their neighbour's second wife. On the wedding night, Zainabu ran away, only to be beaten by her parents and returned to her husband, 19-year-old Mustafa Zanusi. It was after her fourth futile escape, she says, that she forged her desperate plan.
I thought that if I bit his penis really hard, he would let me go.
Zainabu is one of countless children, some as young as 10 or 11, who are taken out of school and married off every year in Niger. The country has one of the highest rates of child marriages in the world. The consequences of early marriages can be devastating. An end to an education which could offer girls a better chance of escaping poverty and illiteracy, as well as many physical and mental health problems. But the practice continues, largely due to widespread traditional views held in many poor communities. But things are slowly improving, Dodo Uma Abani says.
Here in the urban centres, it's not too bad. But in the villages and rural areas, forced marriages continue.
Abani heads the local branch of SOS, Femmes et Enfants Victimes de Violence Familiale, a small human rights organisation funded by international donors helping children suffering violence. Abani and her colleagues have been working hard to change local attitudes and persuade parents that their daughters have a right to a childhood and education. They also support young girls filing for a divorce. Everyone is entitled to choose their partner in marriage of their own free will and when they want it. It's a universal right enshrined in international law. And yet one which Zainabu Musa had to fight so desperately for. After she bit her husband, he fainted and Zainabu escaped once again to her parents' house. And yet again, her parents beat her for disobeying them. The next morning, she says, her husband came to her parents' house and dragged them all to the traditional chief to complain.
He explained what I did to him and said that he wanted to divorce me. That's when I knew it was all over.
When he told the judge what Zainabu had done to him, everyone laughed, even her parents, Zainabu says, her shy smile almost turning into a grin. Her parents have grudgingly agreed to let her finish her schooling before they look for another husband. It will take her another 4 years to finish her education, and then maybe, just maybe, her parents will let Zainabu choose her own partner.
Naomi Conrad reporting. Now, Berlin has been commemorating 20 years after the end of apartheid in 1994. To mark this political milestone in the history of South Africa, renowned South African trumpeter Hugh Masekela was in Berlin and performed some of his music before a crowd of more than 1,800 people. Christian Vieira Teixeira was part of that crowd that enjoyed his music and filed this report.
That's legendary South African jazz musician Hugh Masekela. After 2 hours on stage, the 75-year-old musician raised his trumpet in the air to salute the public.
Hello, Berlin. I'd like to dedicate this song to all the lovers of the world, especially in this crowd tonight. So hold on to your babe.
Every one of Masekela's songs is a picture of his life and a piece of his memories. He is popular all over the world for songs like Grazing in the Grass. He says growing up in South Africa greatly influenced him to become a jazz player.
There is nothing that was ever done in South Africa without music. And then everybody had a gramophone. And there was no television when we grew up. So we had street songs, we had children's songs. We grew up in rallies and strikes and boycotts and marches. And it was just a major part of our lives.
Masekela's compositions also feature experiences under South Africa's former apartheid system, although he says he prefers not to talk about personal experiences.
When 10, 20 million people are oppressed, and you're a little part of it, you don't think about personal experience. And the thing is, I think, to ask, how was it for the government to keep apartheid going, because we lived to beat the system. And we were always ahead of the system. We're smarter, cleverer, and faster than the government. And that's how we beat them eventually, when the people made the country ungovernable.
20 years have gone since the end of apartheid in South Africa. How does Masekela think things have changed since then?
It doesn't mean that the system has changed, because you have it on paper that the people are free. So we still don't own the economy. The economy is owned by all the Western conglomerates and the white establishment of South Africa. And that hasn't changed. If anything, the poverty is worse now than before. The only thing that has changed is that we're not oppressed anymore.
During the concert in Berlin, Hugh Masekela played some of his most famous songs, including the one he composed for Nelson Mandela, Bring Him Back Home. Masekela believes that jazz is something that Africans should always be proud of.
You know, the greatest thing I think that the so-called jazz did is that it showed the excellence of African Americans. You can put Africans down in everything, but you can't take their talent away.
The talking drums and the xylophones, all the dum-dums and the doom-bums, they were waiting. We had a night time of ecstasy.
That beautiful musical piece was filed in by Christian Vera Teixeira.
USA.
Let's hear now what you have to say about the stories we've been covering on this program and on our website. Sela Oneko has been reading through the incoming mail and comments and joined me in the studio before we went on air.
Hi, Isaac. So we got a long letter from Skinner Kadamanja from Malawi, and I'll just read some of it. Thank you, English for Africa, for putting much effort on reporting about Ebola. The way you are announcing it again and again, how people can contract Ebola, even my country is now aware of it. He says that Malawi is now starting to test people entering the country and that the government has asked people to be aware of the signs and the symptoms. So thank you, Skinner, for making us aware of that. And we also put a question to our Facebook followers, which was, does your country have an Ebola hotline? And we got several replies. Kalakula Nasilele wrote, Zambia has one, and it's 909. And Stephen Pipes Afrifra wrote that Ghana has one, even though, like Zambia, it hasn't had any reported cases of Ebola. And then we had a response from Amaka Elochuku, who thinks that Nigeria has one, but she said that the authorities are really lousy when it comes to emergencies. So she believes that even if you call, the help might come too late.
Well, that, of course, is a real concern. But Nigeria does have a hotline, which you can read about more on our website. The hotlines are often manned by medical staff, and so they are also there to answer questions on the signs and symptoms and to dispel any myths or false information. But moving on to the next topic.
Yes, right. We also got a letter from Adisa Maruf from Oshobo in Nigeria, commenting on Wednesday's security meeting in Abuja.
That's the meeting on how to stop Boko Haram's activities. It was attended by foreign ministers from West Africa and officials from the US, France, the UN, and so on and so forth.
Right. And Maruf wrote, the meeting held in Abuja to discuss ways of quashing the insurgency is but an additional move, which in practice has no real impact on the fighting. So far, Nigeria and the neighbouring countries are yet to realise the gravity of the situation.
Yeah, because there have been quite a lot of meetings in Nairobi, Abuja, etc., etc. But you've got some more letters there, isn't it?
Yes, exactly. We have one here addressed to our Learning by Ear radio drama crew from Michel Mfitimukiza and his DW Listeners Club from Rwanda. Michel and his club members also wrote a very beautiful educative story of their own, a bit in the Learning by Ear style.
Let's hear some of it.
Once upon a time, there lived a club who had little land. Its name was Happy Children and was a very kind and good-natured club. We lived in a hut on our own land and earned money by selling whatever crops we could produce from our own land. And it goes on to tell the tale of a jealous neighbor who eventually came around when she felt the kindness of the club.
Thank you, Michelle, and your listeners' club. Unfortunately, we don't have time to hear it all now, but we've passed it on to our Learning by Ear colleagues, who are very glad to receive it. For all listeners out there, you can respond to topics covered on Africa Link or on our website by sending us a text message on +491609575910, an email to feedback.africa@dw.de, or a letter to Africa Link, DW 53110, Bonn, Germany. Yose will be back at the same time next week.
From Cairo to Cape Town, Africa Link, covering the continent.
And before we leave you, here's a reminder of the stories we've covered for you for the last 25 minutes. The International Criminal Court has postponed indefinitely the trial of Kenyan President Uhuru Kenyatta, saying Nairobi was refusing to cooperate. UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon has announced plans to set up an Ebola crisis center to coordinate the response to the deadly virus that has claimed more than 2,000 lives, according to latest figures. We've also been hearing about children forced into early marriages by their parents in Niger. And with that, we come to the end of this edition of Africa Link. For comments and suggestions, as usual, you can send an email to feedback.africa@dw.de, a letter to Africa Link, DW 53110, Bonn, Germany, or an SMS to country code +491609575910. The number is +491609575910. Assumpta Latus will be here with you next week. Do try and join her when you can. And on behalf of the Africa Link team and my producers within the studios, I'm Isaac Mugabe, wishing you a splendid weekend.